Welcome to Voices,
a podcast from the Institute for Human Rights and Business.
Here, we're seeking to elevate the range of perspectives
on the role of business in the world
and in people's everyday lives.
My name's Haley St. Dennis with IHRB's Voices podcast, and I'm here today with Morten Kjørum. He's the director of Raoul Wallenberg Institute of Human Rights and Humanitarian Law in Sweden. And we're here today to talk about the built environment and human rights, and specifically a developing concept of human rights cities. So Morten, firstly, I'd love to know how you got involved in this area.
We got involved with the human rights cities simply because human rights are only interesting if they really unfolded where people live, where they live their everyday life in the neighborhood, where they interact with the municipalities, they meet the police, they are with the health authorities. If human rights are not lived there, I mean, they're not really very relevant for most people. And that was sort of from that outset where we then started looking at what is it that municipalities, local authorities, how do they relate to this? And how do national authorities actually support the regional and the local authorities in realizing human rights? So it was sort of this joining up of the different governance structures that led us deeper into this work.
And so it sounds from your description there like the nub of the issue is that it's a real patchwork of actors. Is that right? And it's about trying to get each to really understand the role they can play when it comes to making human rights real at the local level?
Very much so. I think there may in certain circles been an understanding that human rights is something that is lived in the UN in Geneva or New York Security Council and those places, and they sort of perceived as something high-flying. But in reality, human rights is penetrating everything. It's everywhere because it's all about the respecting, protecting, and fulfilling the human rights of each individual. And that means that any duty bearer, any official, again, could be police, health personnel, or a school teacher, wherever, do have a responsibility to protect the rights and fulfill the rights of the rights holder, the citizen, the person, the child, anywhere. And I think it's that understanding that has prevailed so much stronger in the last 25 years after the end of the Cold War and the whole democratization process. And where we started by taking human rights at the national level, back to the getting the courts to realize that they need to implement the international human rights standards and norms more profoundly. And now the next step is the local level, local authorities. So it's very much about living human rights.
And my understanding is that there's a lot of really exciting activity happening at the local level, particularly on human rights. Are you able to share a few examples of where this concept of human rights cities is really taking hold?
Yeah, I mean, I can take my own little home city here in Lund in southern Sweden, which had declared itself as a human rights city. And that means that, for example, the way they address the school children, how they listen more carefully, instead of taking the outset in the institution, which is very often the case, although most officials and schoolmasters will, of course, always claim that the citizen and the school children are their primary focus, then I think we all know very well that the institutions are very much the primary focus of any administrator, any schoolmaster or director of a hospital or whatever. So what the human rights-based approach does is that it turns the perspective to really put that school child at center. Why is it that this child is in danger of dropping out of the class? Can we actually reach that person? Can we listen more carefully to that child? We also engage with a human rights-based hospital in another part of Sweden, mm-hmm. where simply by taking a human rights-based approach to the psychiatry, they have managed to bring down the use of force in relation to the patients almost down to nothing by again going through all the procedures all sort of say, the entire environment from the perspective of the patient, and it brings about incredible changes. What it really does is that, I mean, I think all Western, but also many other places than in the Western countries, where the neoliberal economy, where efficiency is at the center, new public management is at the center, where the human rights-based approach sort of challenges that approach, bring back the human being where it has been predominantly the economy that has been in focus, or the institution and the process. So that's basically, in short, what we see. Let me just give you another example I had recently in a city that I contributed to the process of them becoming a human rights city, where I had a talk with the city planner. And the city planner really wanted to use a particular piece of land for experimental housing, really trying to understand how do the youngsters, how do the elderly, the single, how do they want to live in the 21st century? We're sort of still building as we always did. And as she told me, before then, when she had ideas like that, the economy guys from the municipality would come and say, oh, sorry, you can't do all that because we get only maximum profit from this piece of land if you build the traditional housing. And normally before, she would have to give in and say, okay, you dictate, because it's always the economy that wins. And after the city had pronounced itself as a human rights city, she could actually pull the human rights card and say, sorry, there are some perspectives which are equally valid as the economic. Of course, the economic argument is still valid, but there is now another equally forceful component or element or set of values. And if they cannot agree, the economist, and in this case, the architect, the city planner, you then bring it up to the level of the city council, the politicians. So it also contributes to recreate a political dialogue that may also have got lost.
Absolutely fascinating. I mean, what really strikes me from the examples you just shared around education, around health and mental health, as well as land and housing, is, I think, for me, the connectedness to the sustainable development goals, and in particular, the concept that if a local or national government, or indeed a business, take the appropriate measures to respect and protect human rights, i.e. to do no harm, you're going to do a great deal to contribute to the realization of the sustainable development goals in that process. So human rights in that sense can actually be incredibly empowering to get things right from the outset and benefit from the smoothness of those processes or those outcomes in the process.
Very much so. It was interesting in the beginning of this process, after the Sustainable Development Goals were adopted in 2015, some cities almost had ideological fights of should we be a Sustainable Development Goal city or should we be a human rights city? Mm. And we had to sort of almost intervene and say, listen, wait, stop. It's not an either or. This is the SDGs and human rights are intimately interlinked and interrelated. And they actually reinforce or strengthen each other. And now, so to say, that battle is no longer there. But the cities realize that taking the outset in the SDGs, which are comprehensive, have all the different elements, and then having the human rights-based approach is really an interesting development tool for any city.
Absolutely. My last question, I suppose, is around where do you start? It's a big area. It can seem very daunting. When you sort of say human rights are everywhere, it can make it difficult to find the right entry point, I would imagine, for a planner or a head of local government or otherwise. Has Raoul Wallenberg looked at that in particular? And are you able to offer advice on the sort of low-hanging fruit or indeed the real root cause areas that everyone should be focusing on?
Of course, you could say you start, if you want to, with the Rolls-Royce model. And you say, well, it should be penetrating all the different dimensions of the work of the municipality. In that case, you would sort of start with the policy making, the political level, and say, okay, the legislation, the strategies, the policies that you develop, human rights should be integrated in that, and then being taken into all the different dimensions of the municipality, in particular four that we have highlighted, and that is the municipality as an employer, so internally, as a service provider, as a democracy provider, and then also facilitating the built environment, the whole city infrastructure, how to ensure the inclusive city. It is a big mouthful, so therefore we also support a lot those cities who say we cannot do it all. We have to prioritize, and we will start in a corner, maybe with children and persons with disabilities, mm-hmm. All dependent on where they have decided to put the main emphasis. So I must say we are pretty relaxed with whether you go for the full spectrum or you want to start more modestly. Where we sometimes hesitate is that if you pick out one element, say we want to do good in relation to integration of immigrants, absolutely perfect, fine, you're all in favor. But then label yourself as a human rights city on one, a singular element is maybe we would hesitate to support that. But if you take, let's say, a small handful of areas and say, let's experiment here, as well as those who buy into the all-encompassing model, we also advise them to when they then start really taking it down through the different parts of the administration, say you need to select your areas. So it is a lengthy process. One element that we stress towards everybody is the almost, we say, the obligation to engage the citizens, the people living in the municipality, in the processes, get people, create a local broad-based ownership to this. That is key and is one of those elements that we believe can recreate trust in democratic institutions if you really manage to engage people in these processes.
Completely agree. It seems to me like the built environment, sort of the city, next to maybe sport, is one of these only areas where I think almost anyone can identify it and really see the positive force that it plays in your individual life and in everyone that you know. So the potential to tap into that and benefit from it as a city that wants to be better connected directly to the people it serves is a bit limitless. So a couple more questions, if I may, Morten. One is around the role of business in a human rights city. We at IHRB, the Institute for Human Rights and Business, always want to make sure we're thinking through the role that business plays in any rights-based approach. And whilst this is a big patchwork area involving a number of actors, would love to hear more about how a business can involve itself in helping a city realize its sort of self-declared ambition of being a human rights city.
When a city has decided to become a human rights city, the next step is to engage broadly, and in particular, I would say, the business sector. In some of the cities where we have been involved, we have seen that working out extremely well. And with a strong commitment from the private sector, actually seeing that that can also highly benefit all the different elements of the business sector, from those, and you say, from the construction to the retail to whatever. The more livable the city is, the more it will, of course, also gain those who make business in that city in terms of attracting smart employers to selling your goods and services. So it is important to involve the business sector as well as civil society in general. That goes for the religious communities, to the sports clubs, to whoever. So that commitment we always stress a lot. Some cities are reluctant, in particular they have difficulties in opening up for the business sector, and they sort of say they're more used to maybe work with the traditional civil society, where they feel more reluctant to engage with private business, but it is important.
I think one thing we certainly advocate as partners, really, IHRB, Raoul Wallenberg, but also other partners in a new coalition we're prompting around the built environment, is taking that full life cycle approach. And I think that can be helpful in cities or businesses understanding the role they play by looking at the full life cycle of a building or a project or a city, Could you say a little more about that approach and also where you're headed next with your work?
Yeah, I mean, on the life cycle of buildings and the built environment, that is crucial. And I'm very proud that the Raoul Wallenberg Institute is part of this coalition, because I must say, when we look around, when we speak with architects and city planners, one should think it was such an obvious thing to do, but we have to say that it isn't. It seems like if we just look at the public space, that a lot of actors are more occupied with the design of the buildings than what happens in between the buildings, where actually the lived life is unfolding, where people meet, where they fall in love, where they look at the shops, go to cafes, etc. So how does that work for everybody and not only for select groups? So the inclusive city, getting that stronger on board as a key concept, I see as very important in this collaboration. But also in that regard, saying, okay, when then the buildings do not longer stand, how are they then being demolished in a sustainable manner? And then going back to all the way to the beginning of the whole thing, when you purchase land, are there anyone living at that land? Are there squatters, marginalized groups that you need to engage, getting involved in the whole process of now developing this particular piece of land? So the human rights dimension of the entire life cycle of buildings is crucial, and I think can make a major difference, both for the private sector, the constructors, the architects, but also definitely for the city planners and the politicians.
That's right, and breaking out of their silos, really. It's too easy to stay in your little lane.
Totally, yeah.
And so where next for your work, Morten?
I would say getting deeper into understanding it better. So we are now entering much further into researching the different dimensions of this, harvesting the experiences from some of the early human rights cities to say what actually worked, what sort of processes internally in the municipalities, and in particular the engagement with the citizens, what has really contributed to a constructive process and what has been less useful. So that is very much where we are, and creating that broader understanding also in particular with the private sector.
Really looking forward to that research. It'll add so much to what I think is currently missing in understanding the depth of the issues across that full life cycle.
Yeah, just entering into in early 2020, next year, we will do a big qualitative survey interviewing a big number of officials in a number of municipalities to start that serious harvesting of experiences.
Oh, fantastic. Are spots still open for municipalities to reach out and get in touch?
Unfortunately not. It is
okay.
a Swedish project, and the municipality is already named. But definitely see that as a pilot,
a
and
phase one.
A study to be followed up.
Well, very good. I hope it gains that momentum, and good luck with your work, Morten. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.